joining us for another episode of WinCast. Today we are joined by Lake Speed Jr. If you've done any research on the internet or you're followed NASCAR, you've known of Lake Speed Jr.'s family's contribution to racing and their successes as well. Lake Speed Jr. is a certified tribologist, spent many years working with Driven Racing Oil, and is currently taking a new job as Vice President for Sales and Marketing for Total Seal Piston Rings. Now, to start off, Lake, I want to talk about oil. Oil debates can get pretty nasty, rank right up there with religion and politics. And the last episode, we talked about a guy who sent us a message about, completely blown away, in his words, that Porsche would develop an engine that would consume one quart of oil for every 1,000 miles, which we know that's inaccurate. It's actually 1 liter per 1,000 kilometers, which is normal consumption. But he was blown away that, you know, that Porsche engines would allow consumption at all. What, you know, a lot of opinions on this matter. So what are your thoughts on it?
It kills me when people have all their, you know, opinions and all this stuff. And it's like, I give a damn less about your opinion. Dude, I got an engine. It's got 350 dyno pulls on it, right? This had 15 cams through it. Every one of them has been ag cold checked. I've got a mountain of data from a real engine and a real thing. That's research. Exactly. Your other stuff is just reading somebody else's damn opinion. I don't care about it.
You know? And the guy's opinion you're reading knows less than you do. That's the thing. He knows less than you do, and 99% of the time. It's just like right here. Check this out. I was going to grab the cat and say, this cat knows more. she hauled ass on me.
But yeah, it's like, no way, I'm out, man.
But that's
he's
the
like,
truth.
I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Don't pull me and throw me under the bus on this one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and see, like I was going to be nice, right? And somebody last week said we were a bunch of arrogant bastards. We're not. There's a difference between being arrogant and being, one, confident in what you do, and two, knowing what the hell you're talking about. But see, I took this shirt off, right? This is what I was wearing. No, you're right. Let's do it the dumbest way possible because that's easier for you. Yeah. See? That's what I was wearing all day long.
Well, you know, that goes back, though. This is why Jake and I have worked so well together. I will never forget it. The first day you and I talked, I was, Blake, who works for you, is, I guess it's his father-in-law, right?
Yeah.
Ed Preston was a guy that I know from work when I was working at Joe Gibbs. They were one of our reps, and he said, oh, you got to meet this guy, Jake. And so we talked, and remember we sat there and chatted. I was in a parking lot of an engine shop in East Tennessee that builds drag race motors, and I'd just been in there trying to help them out with some, oddly enough, ring seal issues. Right, they had some problems on break-in, and we were talking about break-in oil and how to get everything sealed up. And I remember talking to you, and I remember when we hung up, I was like, now this is a guy I think I can work with, because it's all about, you know, experiential. It's not about, yep, you know, what you think or concept. It's like, no, let's test something. Let's find out, not just, you know, discuss it. Let's actually get some product in an engine, do some testing, oil analysis, have real data, and then go from there. And you and I have been in the trenches doing that ever since, you know, and that's what's been great about it, you know, is be able to have that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the only way you can learn and research this stuff is firsthand. You know, I have people come to classes sometimes, And the guy, you know, they come to a class because they want to learn, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. And we show them how to do things. And sometimes what we show them is kind of unorthodox to them because they come from this experiential way of living in the rest of their life and what they do in their work. And they can't grasp the fact that we just get it done. While everybody else is busy talking about what they are going to do, we have already done it, blown it up, fixed it two or three more times, and learned what didn't work while they were thinking about doing it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And that's the case. You just got to do it, you know? You just have to jump in there and do it. If it blows up, you know what doesn't work. and then you go back and you try it again. But that's we did it with every oil I've helped you with. It's like, okay, let's just get this and see what happens. Let's change this. Let's change that. Let's change. And then used oil analysis. And it goes down to, what does the oil smell like? I mean, it's crazy what you learn, right? It's today I was, we were riding four wheelers and dirt bikes and stuff. All the cousins were down here. Ava was out riding her Honda, and I got that smell. You know, it was like, there it is, you know, and it's been a long time since I've gotten that smell that we always associated with that old ARG product, you know, and there it was, boom. And it's, you know, when you know how an oil smells, you know what it looks like when you have ring seal, you know what it looks like when you don't have ring seal. And then when it blows up in your face and you know what it tastes like, that is research. That is your research, not freaking Google. That pisses me off. Well, it happens every week now. I'm doing my research. No, dude, you are wasting your time reading a bunch of stupid shit that some dumbass put on the internet that's trying to act like he knows more than he does. That is what happens every. Oh, I'm worried about my internet reputation. Yeah, how many posts have you made? I mean, that's what gets me. It's the stupidest thing ever. I mean, we rate people on how many posts they've made, and they're talking about how many times. This is really a topic. How many times should I wash my car? I've seen that. How many times should I wash my car? There's no answer to that other than how dirty is your car? Okay, yeah, I live on a dirt road, right? How many times should I wash my car? It's the stupidest thing ever. And then, forums. At the bottom of the forum, you have to have 6 or 8 lines of all the stupid stuff you bolted onto your car that doesn't work in most of the cases because somebody made it up that doesn't even know the 4 strokes of a 4-stroke engine. And you have to have this shifter and that shifter, and you have to have this and that. Oh, yeah. And then, like, they add all this stuff up. Like, I got the GT3 throttle body. I got the IPD planner. I got this. And I add all this stuff up, right? But it's just like that Common Core math crap they're trying to teach the kids these days. That stuff don't add up to me either. And neither do any of these modifications.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this gives me 25 horsepower. This gives me 35 horsepower. Well, no, actually, the first one took 5 horsepower away from what the stock power was. The second one made the engine go rich because now the MAF sensor's pissed off. Now you're killing your cylinders and you're contaminating your oil and you're killing your ring seal while you lost another 5 horsepower.
Should we go ahead and mention about clutches right now?
Yeah. It's a good one. It's a good one. I got to have a race clutch. Yeah, so my car drives like absolute shit. The car drives horrible, right?
Right.
Like, the clutch is on or off. It may as well have a 5,000 RPM stall converter for a drag car. You know, and then they take off. Oh, my car doesn't have very good manners. I have this flywheel that's 27.5 pounds lighter than stock. It's giving me false knocks. So now my knock sensors think that I have detonation going on. And when I've got the car in neutral while I'm in a drive-through, it sounds like my transmission's grenading. Awesome.
Yeah, because it was balanced, but now it's not. Ah!
Exactly. It's great. I mean, I get so tired of that. But it is what it is. And I completely gave up on trying to tell people what not to do. It's like I completely gave up on them telling them not to run Noble None, right?
Right, yeah.
But it is what it is. Run it. Well, run
I had a question.
The only thing is I wish I could put a brochure with all of those oil bottles that says, after this doesn't work for you, even though the owner manual says it does, and that stupid little sticker in the engine bay too, even after this doesn't work, now you can call me. But – you know, you might have bought 5 liters of oil on special at Walmart and got a good deal on it, but they're damn sure not going to put anything towards your $25,000 engine build.
Oh, no. What is it, Bobby?
Well, I was going to say, one of the questions after our last Jake Raw interview from last week, they said, okay, you got us. If it's not Mobile One, then what is it? And I'm thinking, you didn't listen to what he said at the very beginning. He's not going to recommend oil. But do you want to? share what you would?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
That's a lake question. Because see, the thing
And that's
this is the thing now, right? Because Lake doesn't even work there anymore. Now
he works at Tokyo. Got no skin in the game. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not like he's not the snake oil salesman anymore. You know.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Jake and Lake. If you're dealing with a non-direct injection engine like the M9X series of Porsche engines, it seems like I remember the recommendation would be DT40 if it's a 9 alpha 1 engine with direct injection. You would recommend like the DI40,
correct?
From Driven. I know Charles Naval from Ellen Engineering says if you gotta have a Porsche approved A40 oil, then Motul
8100 XS.
8100 XS is
for an A40,
a good oil.
Yeah. My daughter that basically handles all the day-to-day like paperwork stuff in processing for Speed Diagnostics, you know, the used oil analysis deal, she even will tell me. So if I don't even look at the paperwork to see what brand oil it is, if I just look at the raw parts per million numbers, she says, I can tell you what oil it is without even looking at it. Because the Driven stuff and the Motul 8100 XS are going to have their own signature. And the Mobile One, she says, I know it's a mobile sample before I even look at it. Because it's going to have the same characteristics over and over and over again. You know, it's an oil that's designed for fuel economy. Yes, it's A40 approved. You know, again, like Jake said, I don't have any skin in the game. I was very fortunate, you know, after growing up with, you know, my dad, you know, being a NASCAR guy, former world go-karting champion, you know, that's my background. I grew up at a racetrack. I grew up around engines my whole life. And then, you know, into my dad's career transition, I went to work for Melling Racing. So I worked, you know, Ernie Elliott there in Dawsonville, Georgia. He was our engine guy. And so working for Melling and then making the transition to Joe Gibbs and, you know, ending up at Joe Gibbs in the heart, you know, the kind of the peak of NASCAR in terms of, you know, 2004, 2005 were, you know, the real halcyon days there where, you know, every NASCAR engine builder had a development program with a Formula One team. You know, we did work with McLaren. You know, they came and tested EFI systems that are now on NASCAR cars 15 years ago at Joe Gibbs Racing. And, you know, so we had that ability to learn so much. And that's really what, you know, being part of that oil program, which I'm very proud of, because that's what led me into the world of tribology, you know, which is the study of friction, wear, and lubrication. So it's not just oil, it's the whole system. And, you know, that was my job, is that I got to know everything about those engines, you know, that was related to friction, wear, and lubrication. You know, I saw a guy the other day. I know jack diddly about airflow. I mean, I know a little bit of aerodynamics, but I'm not an airflow. I'm not a cylinder head guy, a manifold guy. I don't know that stuff because that's not what I did for 15 years. But for 15 years, I studied friction, wear, lubrication, and everything related to it chemistry-wise.
So, you know? Late. Yeah. Before, I love this. But you got my curiosity going. What was it about the Porsche M9X engine that was developed from 1997 to 2008? What was it about that engine that we needed the industry to develop better oil over the common 040 oil that everybody thinks is the one to go with?
A couple of things about that engine that are pretty unique. You know, one, you know, tribology is friction, wear, lubrication. Well, wear isn't just about the oil. It's about the surface finish, and the materials. You know, one of the key things, one of the reasons, you know, why, you know, the Total Seal relationship with me working for Total Seal, you know, it was a natural progression for me. It wasn't like a step to the back or away. It was a step up in my journey in tribology. Because, you know, back to the cup thing just for a second, you know, every Joe Gibbs Racing engine built since 2002 has Total Seal piston rings in it. So when we were developing the oil, it was in conjunction with the piston rings. And one of the things we did is we actually would test different coatings in different ring materials along with the oil, because they have to work together. To the M96, M97 engines, it's an alu-sil bore. That's a very, very unique material.
I thought the M9X was Lock-A-Seal.
Well, yeah, Lock-A-Seal.
The 9-Alpha-1 was alu-sil.
Okay.
Which,
you're being specific. Okay. Yeah. The point being, either one of them.
But it's not a nickel seal. It's not the nickel seal.
It's not nickel seal. It's an aluminum alloy with impregnated silicon. All right. There's two different ways they came across it, right? Between, you know, say, Lock-A-Seal and Alu-Seal, but they're both the same thing. They're both an aluminum alloy with silicon nodules. That is a completely different surface finish in material than a traditional cast iron bore, even an aluminum block with nickel seal, completely different. We make completely different rings with completely different coatings, be it an alu-sil bore, a nickel seal bore, or a cast iron bore. It can be the same ring base material. It can be the same diameters, the same dimensions, but they will have different face coatings on them. Sometimes it's even different substrate materials based on those three things. So that's where people lose it. Yes, it's a flat six engine. Yes, it's this. But unless you know what you're talking about in terms of surface finish in the materials, you've missed the whole game, because that's where the lubricant has to be designed to work with it. A lot of people don't realize that most of the additives in the motor oil will not work on non-ferrous surfaces. That means if you can't put a magnet on it and it's going to stay, it won't work.
Gotcha.
And so that's one of the key things, is that the chemistry has to be able to work with the materials, and there's an understanding of the surface finish. And then, you know, one of the key things, and I actually used this last week on a seminar we did for the Automotive Engine Rebuilders Association. We were talking about break-in procedures. And I actually used the Boxster engine that Jake built for me when I was at Driven to prove out, right, a new formulation of break-in oil. And that how, you know, was the first thing we did was, one, we warmed the engine up, you know, made sure the oil was flowing through it, ran it around town a little bit, stop, start, getting some load on it. But then once we kind of did that initial warm-up, getting everything flowing through the engine, we changed it, put fresh oil in, and what did Jake do? Hog pin gap, you know, all the way up, driving like bat out of hell, all through the gears, back down. Why? You had to put load on the engine to get the thing to seat in properly. And there are so many people out there, and I've heard it and seen it over and over again. Oh, if it's not a flat tappet cam engine, you don't have to break it in. You just put it on a run-in stand or something like that, and you just let it idle, and you heat cycle it. Well, without load on the engine, idle, there's zero cylinder pressure. How well is that going to seat up, Jake?
Well, it doesn't. That's the thing. Right. So, you know, and this is a problem I have with customers, because it's hard to get that perfect medium of somebody driving the car just hard enough and driving it too hard, and they don't understand thermal cycling. The engine has to get hot naturally to all the way to the point where the thermostat's open for 10 or 15 minutes, shut it off, let it cool completely down, and then do that over again. They don't understand that, which I don't know why that's so hard. And the second thing is, they want to treat it like a little infant, like it's a little fragile baby. So that's why when a car comes to us, we put 104 miles on it, but it's not overly stressful for the engine, because we're not driving the car to maximum potential, but we are putting a lot of load and cylinder pressure on it. Because if you notice, like when we went up that mountain, basically the flat six ring is 52 miles in a loop. We go up a mountain, Richard Russell Scenic Highway, Hog Pin Gap. We go down the other side. Okay. Then we go about 11 miles of curvy road that's almost flat, and then we climb another mountain and then come back down the other side of it. So as I'm going up those mountains, I'm in a gear that is not optimum. You know, if I should be in third gear to climb that, I'm in fifth, and I'm pedal down. I'm working that sucker hard. I'm at low RPM, I'm at high load, and that makes those rings, it forces the rings to work. Then when I go down the other side, what do I do? It's the opposite. I'm engine braking, okay, which basically means I'm in a gear lower than I normally would be. I'll actually accelerate down the mountain as fast as I can safely. And then let's say I do that in fourth gear, I'll jam it in third from that point, and I'll let it hold 6,000 RPM all the way down a 3-mile hill, basically. And I just let it slow itself all the way down. So now we've increased the load like crazy at low RPM and high cylinder pressure. And then we get to the top of the mountain, give it a little bit of a break for a couple minutes, take a couple of pictures of it, send it to the guy that owns the car. And then I go beat it and I let it decelerate as much as I can. And I learned that actually from my brother. And he builds, or used to, a lot of airboat motors. So what he would do, Continentals and Lycomings, okay, they would crank up a brand new one, put the boat on the trailer while the engine's idling, and they would drive down Interstate 75 at 75 miles an hour. So the air coming through the propeller forces it to do the same thing that I was doing. It makes it break in. This is forced break in is what this is. So that's why when I get customers sometimes, they want to drive it too easy or they want to drive it too hard. So now what I've been doing is we won't let them drive it too hard. I've got a break in tune. We load a break in tune after we're finished with it. It limits them to 80% of throttle response, and it limits the engine to 5,200 RPM. They can't hurt it. I say, look, drive it to its maximum potential. I don't do it so they can't hurt it. Well, I kind of do because I had a guy that right off the truck went 140 miles an hour and wondered why that was a bad thing on break-in oil. And then he hurts the engine and drives it 70 miles home and doesn't even think that's anything odd to do. But, you know, we call him Mr. 140 miles an hour.
A little too far, yeah.
A little too far. But the thing is now, it's like, okay, we're not doing that anymore. I limit what you can do throttle response-wise. I limit what you can do RPM-wise. Now just go drive it as hard as you can because you're not going to hurt or be able to do more than what you should. So doing that makes it easier for me because I say, you can't hurt it. Drive it to the maximum potential that I have allowed you. We get to that first 1,500 miles, which is our intermediate oil change, okay, after we've done our work. Then we've been going, you know, from there to another intermediate oil, okay? And I see how it's doing with consumption. I can tell a lot about how the guy's driving. Sometimes I'll hook up some of my gear, and I'll see how the guy's been driving it. And then we go from there with what we're going to do for oil after that 1,500-mile mark. You know, with some of them I've been doing GP1. Other ones I've been doing some other stuff that you and I have worked with. So that's just a little bit about break-in. And I have a lot of people email me. And they're like, you know, I've built my engine up. Now I want you to help me break it in. Well, I didn't build it. I don't know the clearances. I don't know the tolerances. I don't know what you use for parts. And on top of that, I don't care. It's my job to build an engine and to research what it's supposed to do the best way possible, not to help you build yours. So, you know, if you want me to do that, well, if you want my opinion on break-in, buy my engine. I mean, that's pretty much the way I look at that.
Well, like you said, there's too many variables. There's too many variables for you to be the email or telephone diagnostic guy and say, well, here, you need to go this RPM, this amount of throttle, this. You can't know that. You know, it's like I said, you build your engine and you know all those factors. You know what the ring end gaps are. You know what the piston to wall clearance is. You know what your, you know, low speed fuel delivery is going to be and all that. You know what you've got the thermostat set to, so you can go out there and control all that. You know, you've seen it because we've done how many thousands of oil analysis samples together over the last 15 years. 10 times more wear occurs during break-in than any other time that engine's life. So it's the most critical time, you know, in that engine's life. So you got to do it right. And especially when you get into things like Nicosil and Alucil and things like that that aren't common, you've got to treat it that way. And you just got to know those tricks. And that's what they pay you for is that you've already been there, done that. It's not that I've read an article about it, you know, on the internet. I've actually done it myself. And I know
what to do. And, you know, that's where, you know, people, I still get the questions, you know, like you said, about the driven stuff. And I'm like, no, I mean, to me, the GP1 for any engine that's not direct injected is the best stuff that I've personally ever tested. And I think it's fantastic. If it's a direct injected engine, I really do like the DI stuff that they make. I think it's a really good product. I've been happy, you know, the work we did with that, you know, you and I together, in addition to the work we did with General Motors and Oak Ridge National Lab, the work that Oak Ridge put into that product, and the guys at Oak Ridge are, in my opinion, some of the first-class scientists in the whole world, that product went over and above and blew away everybody there. And that's the National Transportation Research Committee. You know, they're pretty high-level guys, a lot of funding, seeing a lot of things, and they were all just blown away by what that stuff could do in terms of wear protection and things like that. You know, 0W12 in an engine built for 5W30, and it produces lower wear metals than, you know, a 5W30 does. Oh, and by the way, it also gave you a 5% fuel economy increase. I mean, those are the kind of things we got to do, which is fun. You know, and I'm proud of the time we spent at Driven, you know, and what we accomplished there. But I'm really more excited now to be doing what we're doing with Total Seal and trying to work out new things, you know, with the rings. We've already learned stuff already, you know, that people didn't even know was there. And I think we'll continue to move that bar higher and higher, like we always have.
Yeah, and I mean, we're, you know, that's part of the research behind all this, and knowing, like you said, clearances, in gaps, all those things, and knowing when those need to be changed, you know?
Right.
When does a variable call for that change? It's just like, you know, I built one of my 4.4 liter engines for a customer, and, you know, we use some really radical rods and rod bearings and crankshaft with this combination. It's not Porsche parts. It's not anything anybody would ever believe is inside that engine. That's all I'm going to say. And at the same time, these are very well-proven components in other engines. But I told the guy, look, before I even build this engine, it's going to need 2050 engine oil, okay? I knew that because I knew what the clearances had to be to make all this stuff work, and I knew the way we were building it. And sure enough, we get it all put together. It loves 2050. It hates anything as a 40 grade from an oil pressure perspective at low RPM. And it operates like an engine with tighter clearances that has a 40 grade, as long as it's not mobile one, which really tests like a 30 grade if it's a 40. Okay. And with the 2050, it has the same pressure, oil pressure at hot idle and even at hot high RPM as what we normally see from a 40 grade oil with another internal combination. So that's part of what we're doing. A lot of these guys that are trying to put these engines together, and I'm talking about professionals, they're just bolting stuff together. And see, people that want to buy an engine, they don't know that. They are doing their research and they call all these people and they don't understand that an engine builder doesn't bolt things together. An engine builder builds that engine in his mind, and then you transfer that into tangible things that you can put together with a plan, and then you know how it's going to operate. Well, part of that equation, the combination, as we say, is the oil, a big part of it.
Oh,
and it's just like people don't understand, you know, one reason why piston rings and cylinders are such a big deal from an oil perspective is because they are boundary layer protection. We're dealing with splash, right? Splash oil is pretty much what's giving them their ability to lubricate. We're not delivering oil directly to them except with the piston squirters, which kind of suck most of the time in these engines.
They're there for cooling.
Exactly. You know? They're mostly there for cooling, obviously. But, you know, the better boundary layer protection we get, the better off we are. And then you get into the whole windage thing, right? Windage and aerating the oil. That's something I've noticed about the GP1 also. It doesn't aerate. That stuff doesn't aerate at all. And we've done some dyno pulls, and it goes back to the old days when everybody wanted to swap over to a diesel oil. And that makes no sense because diesel engines, a high-speed diesel is 3,000 RPM, right? That's a high-speed engine. So why are you going to take an oil that might have a decent additive pack for a diesel operating on diesel fuel with all the hydrocarbons and crap that diesel creates in the cylinder pressures that diesel has? why do you even think you could put that oil into a high-speed sports car engine that's going to turn 7,000 RPM and it not aerate? Because that diesel oil doesn't have the properties of a windage issue. You know, when you're turning 3,000 RPM with a crankshaft that weighs 100 pounds or more, you don't really care that much about windage. But with these engines, we do. And we found that aerating the oil kills that film strength. Makes that oil act like a much lighter weight oil. It doesn't protect the components as much. It doesn't have good boundary layer protection because as soon as it hits the cylinder walls, it turns, it's foamy, it runs right off.
Yep.
And so that's what they don't understand. But, you know, all you have to have is a dyno and an oil drain pan. That's all you have to do. The engine 6,000 RPM for about 3 or 4 minutes with one oil in it. Immediately, before you even shut the thing off, the drain plug's coming out. And as soon as that oil dumps out, if it looks like a German beer that has a head of foam on it this tall, that oil sucks. Or if you add a product to your engine that promotes windage, like some of these people are doing, trying to spray oil from a hose inside an internal, you know, onto a dynamic component inside the engine, they don't understand that's making foam. So, you know, the whole windage thing goes into this too. So it's not just the viscosity, not just the additive package. It's not any of those just things. It's no one thing that makes the difference. It's all of those things together. And we learned that, right? We learned that sometimes we would play with something and all of a sudden it would hurt the viscosity after it ran for a while. Or we even learned that the winter blend fuels were impacting things. The winter blend fuels were creating oil consumption in an engine that did not have consumption on summer blend fuels. So this is the research that's real and stuff that you have to learn in the trenches.
I mean, think about it. I gave you all the updates when we drove the Boxster from your shop all the way to Spokane, Washington for the Porsche parade and back. We measured fuel consumption and oil consumption, whether or not the fuel had ethanol in it. Simple as that, you know, and it was as plain as day that you had better fuel economy and less fuel oil consumption when you had non-ethanol fuel. You know, that's just one of those, that was one of the light bulb moments where, you can know about it and you can read about it and go to the classes, but then when you do it in real life, you can see it, it just reaches out and smacks you across the face, you know? It's like, here it is, dummy.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of RenCast. I want to thank you for joining us today. And we hope that you'll consider subscribing to our YouTube channel, as well as follow us on Facebook. Now, if you prefer to listen to us, you can do that on our podcasting channels on Apple iTunes, as well as Google Podcasts and Spotify, to name a few. Again, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.